welcome to a Grad Chat, your opportunity to find out about graduate research here at Queen's. My name is CJ the DJ, and I am your host for this week's Grad Chat. Of course, a show like this could not happen without the support of the School of Graduate Studies and Postdoctoral Affairs, as well as CFRC, so thank you very much to both of them. Now, if your mates miss the show at any time, you can download the podcast the next day on either iTunes, Google Podcasts, Spotify, and CFRC Podcast. So no excuse not to hear what our awesome students and postdoctoral fellows are doing. Today, though, I would like to introduce you to Eileen O'Brien, who is doing a Master of Science in Biomedical and Molecular Sciences under the supervision of Dr. Daniel Mulder. Welcome to Grad Chat, Eileen.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Now, I've been waiting for Eileen to come on for a little bit. She took a bit of a hiatus from our first email to each other about this. Okay, I'm going to ask you this. Why did you want to come on Grad Chat?
Well, in the similar way of why I want to do the 3MT, I think it's a great way of practicing communicating my research. You know, I think being in a lab and always talking to people in science, you get a little too in the science realm and you kind of forget how to talk about it in open ways. And I think that also has value, you know, trying to communicate to kind of the lay audience, as you would say, also helps with understanding my own research on a deeper level, you know, especially when I'm reading reports, I think I understand something, but I'm saying exactly what I read in literature. So until I can really communicate that in my own words, dumbed down in a certain way, that's like when I realize I really understand what I'm doing.
And that's very good. I wouldn't call it dumbing it down.
I
would call it more of making it more accessible.
Yes.
And also for you, as you're saying, making sure you actually do understand the concepts and the theory and everything else that you're doing. I always make this analogy of, you know, we can have these certain formulas, fantastic, in a test. Don't give me the formula because I should understand each component of that formula. Mm-hmm. So I should know which formula to use. And that used to always bug me. So this is great that you're doing this. And I know when you did your 3MT, that was also part of this learning experience that you're doing. I mean, that wasn't easy, 3 minutes.
And no.
we say, oh, no, you'll be fine. But I know it's not easy. It does take a long time, doesn't it?
No, it does. And, you know, especially with the program I'm in, you have to deliver a couple seminars throughout the term. And so you get, you know, 10 and then 20 minutes. And so when I first read 3MT, I was like, oh, 3 minutes, that's no problem. You know, I've done 10, I've done 20, you know.
And then, that should be a breeze.
And then I got to it, I was like, wow, this is a lot harder than I thought. So, you know.
And it's finding, and we say this all the time, is, you know, what do we want people to know? You know, what is the main message? And if you've got 3 minutes, how much can you actually say in that? As opposed to today, we're going to do 29 minutes. And so I'm going to give you a lot more time to explain what you do. But, yeah, it's getting, what do we want people to know? And and some of our workshops on, you know, who's your audience?
Yeah.
It's really going to depend on the audience and how much they understand, which is very different when you go into a conference.
Exactly, yes. I know, especially a conference, you're there. It's like different levels of intimidation. It's, you know, at a conference, you're there with all people specialized in your field. So it's like, wow, if I mess up, they know. But on the other side, like with the 3MT, it's, you know, making sure everyone understands. So you have to understand every single component, the nitty-gritty, to be able to answer, you know, for anyone who wouldn't understand or wouldn't know.
Well, on that note, we should probably find out exactly what you have been studying for these past 2 years. Mm-hmm. And so your research topic is, and I'm going to give you both. I'm going to give the academic and then what you use in your 3MT, because that might be easier for people. So your academic research topic is using various histology techniques to investigate the impact that the cytokine CCL3 might have on mediating inflammatory bowel disease, or IBD. For the rest of us, that actually can be translated into the 3MT heading, gut healing and covering immune pathways contributing to IBD. Much prefer that second one. And I guess that's not even easy to figure out how to change your research topic into something more simple.
Mm-hmm.
for us, but well done on that. So you basically, you're talking about IBD. That's the big thing, in irritable bowel disease. But there's IBS as well, and I'm sure people might get confused between IBD and IBS. So can you give us the descriptions of both? Mm-hmm. And then why have you been focusing on IBD and the prevalence in Canada?
Yes. So IBD is an immune disorder, so inflammatory bowel disease. It's, you know, kind of an inappropriate reaction of your immune system leading to over-inflammation and tissue damage in your gastrointestinal tract. I'll usually say GI for shortening it, but yeah, your gastrointestinal tract. Whereas IBS, irritable bowel syndrome, is more of a kind of physical and functional disorder. So this can be brought on by, you know, an intolerance to food. And so that's just how your body is reacting. Whereas, yeah, IBD, you know, the cause isn't really understood all that much. Kind of a running theory is that it's, you know, there's a genetic component, and that doesn't necessarily say you're gonna get IBD, but it's more of an environmental trigger to a genetic susceptible person might cause this IBD to come about. But the symptoms are very similar, like very, very similar. So that's why a lot of people do confuse the two, but it's more of a deep down in your body difference.
So what is the prevalence then of IBD in Canada?
Yeah, so Canada, one of the countries with the highest prevalence, really? Specifically in children, like pediatric IBD is on a steep incline, specifically in Canada, and we have the highest amounts. I know, it's a little scary, a little spooky.
It is scary. I didn't realize that.
Yeah. So, I mean, the actual prevalence as of 2023 is 0.8%, which doesn't sound like a lot, but it's increasing more and more. And then by, I think it was 2045, it'll be 1.1%. So it is increasing quite a bit. And, you know, for a disease that's not well understood and has, you know, consequences, and, you know, it's not fun to have. So it's something of to really study and something of concern. So
what are some of the, how do you know if you've got IBD? You know, what's, I mean,
right,
you talked about IBS.
Yeah.
You can get irritable stomach and things, but what are the
symptoms? Or
Thank you very much. What are the symptoms of IBD?
So, you know, there'll be a different, usually it is, yes, you have like stomach pain, cramping, you know, diarrhea and stuff. And so there's two divisions of IBD. There's ulcerative colitis and Crohn's disease. And so from my understanding and readings, it's been, you know, ulcerative colitis, there'll be blood in your stool, whereas with Crohn's disease, there might not necessarily be. And so with children, for example, I was reading that there was more Crohn's disease prevalence in children than ulcerative colitis. Okay. And because it's not bloody stool, you know, a parent will see whatever and they're like, oh, okay, they just have diarrhea. But, you know, it
could be more than that.
And so, you know, a patient will come in and, you know, they will have symptoms. Some might not. There's been, you know, my supervisor talks about sometimes patients will come in or it'll be a kid and, you know, they're acting like all is good in the world. And then you look at their blood work and all that and it's like, no, they're like really like having an immune reaction. So symptoms are a way of, you know, that's usually what gets you in the office. And then you do some blood work and then you can do some imaging, do an endoscope, which is a camera, which isn't always fun to receive.
No, not for a kid either.
No, especially not for a kid. And so those are all ways of confirming that you have inflammatory bowel disease.
So I'm baffled about why people want to get into the guts, you know, and the digestive system and all that. What made you want to go into that? Or was it given to you? And you go, yeah, okay, I'm going to do that research.
Yeah, I always had an interest in pathology and understanding disease. And so I was at a previous lab I was working at, I was doing a lot of histology work. And so my current supervisor, Dr. Daniel Mulder, he reached out to me and said, you know, we study IBD and, you know, gut, which was different than your previous subject, but I see you're doing a lot of histology work and we would like to do histology work.
Okay.
And so that's how it came about. And with my program, like life sciences, you know, you in your upper years, you take cardiovascular research and neuroscience, but there was never really a gastrointestinal subject, like higher level. So the last time I had studied it was in second year in our physiology class. So I kind of saw it as an opportunity to, wow, like I haven't learned about this at all, like in years. So, and it's been fun.
So what is the focus of your lab then? Because I mentioned before in your research topic, the cytokine CCL3.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm assuming the focus of your lab is on that, whatever that is.
Yes. So how that's come about is, you know, the overall, I guess, goal of our lab is understanding IBD and kind of finding new ways of monitoring the disease.
Right.
And so how that came about was a previous master's student in our lab, his name was Chinmay, and he was doing analysis of cytokine levels, which cytokine are immune markers and proteins.
That's what it is, right?
Yeah, they're proteins. And so he was studying different levels of different cytokines in your blood. And so he found that CCL3, and so specifically lower levels of CCL3 in your peripheral blood, was a positive predictor of inflammatory bowel disease. And so the theory was that potentially it's lower in your peripheral blood because it's being focused and more expressed within your gastrointestinal tract at sites of inflammation.
So you're looking at more of that.
Yeah, so exactly. So I've decided to delve deeper into understanding potentially the role of CCL3. And so I guess some background on that. It works as a macrophage chemoattractant. And okay. So
what's a macrophage?
Yes. So it's an immune cell. And so it mostly works by engulfing,
all the
dead
and the bad things.
All the bad things, yeah. Okay. And so it can release certain levels of markers as well. So it can either, there's ongoing research with macrophages. They, based on, a cytokine that it might be exposed to, it can either become a pro-inflammatory, so a bad macrophage, or a healing macrophage, so what you would want.
Okay.
But the tendency with IBD is that there's more, the word is polarization, so turning into the pro-inflammatory macrophages, so the bad type. So there's more of those bad type macrophages circulating. Yeah, not good.
No, I mean, if anyone can see my face right now, I'm turning my lips up and and nose and scrunching.
Yes. Yeah. So what I'm trying to determine is, one, is there more CCL3 at these sites of inflammation? So
right.
As its role of attracting these macrophages, is it attracting the bad macrophages or the good macrophages?
Good.
So, and understanding, its role kind of in that sense.
Well, that's not going to be easy, is it?
No. So
how do you do that, though?
Yes. So the first steps are identifying levels of CCL3.
Mm-hmm.
So we get gut biopsy tissues of patients with IBD.
Okay.
And so what I can do is I can...
So how do you... Sorry, I'm going to backtrack.
Oh, yeah, no
how
worries.
Do you get those tissues? Is it like a blood sample? Is it going in and cutting a bit of something?
Yes, yeah. So,
the latter.
Yeah, it is, yeah. Oh. It'll come from the surgeon who performed it. And so
okay.
There's an archive in Kingston General Hospital of all these.
Right.
And so we got permission to use some of those. And it's essentially, what I see when I get them is this piece of tissue, a little tiny little piece of tissue, is in a wax block, and then you kind of shave it. I guess how you can visualize it is when you're going to a deli.
Yes,
and
yes.
A thin slice of salami.
Yes.
So like that. And so I can stain it, that
right.
small tissue, with a CCL3 antibody. And so that kind of will identify the cells expressing CCL3. And so it'll stain those cells a brown pigment, and then I can look and quantify that. So I'm looking at the percent positive expression. So how many cells are expressing CCL3 over total amount of cells? So
that's not easy from a little slither that you've got. And okay, you may not be able to answer this.
Mm-hmm.
Just say they got the little slither from the wrong part of the tract.
Yes. Yeah, yeah.
Which is the other part's okay. Or does it show throughout the tract?
So that's a very good question, actually. So with the different two types, there's the, as I said, the ulcerative colitis and the Crohn's disease.
Mm-hmm.
Crohn's disease can be found, inflammation all through your gastrointestinal tract. My supervisor used to say something funny. It was like, mouth to something, but it's like right. essentially your mouth to your anus, like right. anywhere.
All the way through. Yeah.
Anywhere, whereas your ulcerative colitis is mostly focused in your large intestine. Right. But essentially how they go about choosing where it's mm-hmm. located or like will where they'll take the biopsy from is when they're in there with their camera looking
they
around.
They see the inflammation.
They'll see inflammation. They're like, let's just grab a little pinch from there.
From there.
Exactly.
Right. So yeah, okay, well, that makes sense. Yeah. Otherwise, finding a needle in a haystack,
exactly,
isn't it?
Yeah.
So, yeah. Which we don't want. We want it to be more than that.
Yes.
With all this information that you're gathering, mm-hmm. and luckily, like you said, you've got this bank of tissue that you can access from yes. KGH. What is the value of using something like bioinformatics to identify the patterns in this immune cell expression? Because I imagine with all this data, it's going into the computer and the computer's doing whatever it needs to do.
Exactly.
To help you. So what is the value
yeah.
of getting all these little samples and making a determination of the data that's yes. within that tiny sample?
Yes. Well, so for one, I'm using it for getting the results. So as I mentioned, counting those cells, it's a lot of cells, a lot of tissue. Mm-hmm. So there is now technology and, you know, applications that you can use. And so it'll automate that process of counting. So it'll identify okay. cells and based on pixels and all that pixel colors, it can identify.
Oh, that's handy.
It's very handy. And it's great. You know, the things that are coming out in technology nowadays, I'm often on these little web platform chats and chatting right. with people. And so, you know, it's fun to do.
I guess that's a lot easier than just your own visuals yeah. from using a microscope, isn't
yes.
it? It can be a lot more specific.
It's a lot more specific. And then faster, you know, I'd be at a microscope all day. I do obviously check that the computer is like the application's working how it should. So I do a little quick passover. But in terms of data collection and putting that into, you know, Excel sheets and all that, it makes that a lot faster.
Well, that's good, particularly when you have 2 years for your master's.
Yeah, exactly. And then, yes, as you mentioned, it's a lot of data. And so specifically another part that we're now focusing on and so of my project, which is identifying. So before I was saying like quantifying the CCL3 expression.
Yes.
Now I'm trying to identify the identity of the cell. So and by doing that is looking at different markers that it can express.
Okay.
So those, you know, bad and good macrophages, they express different markers. So for an example, I'll say there's something like it's called a CD8 T cell. And so that's another type of inflammatory cell.
Okay.
But the two markers that I can see on it would be CD3 and CD8. But so in my research, I have 37 different markers. So I'm using a computer to basically cluster all these different markers based on, it's a whole algorithm that it passes through, but essentially it's how close the markers are mm-hmm. to each other within the boundary of a cell will identify what that cell is.
And so it's looking for patterns.
Exactly.
Looking for patterns along the way. And then when you find these patterns,
yes.
though,
yep.
then what? Because it's great. You've got all these patterns.
Exactly.
Does that mean I'm going to be okay? Does that mean, we need to do something to help you out?
Yeah.
Or has no effect whatsoever?
Right. Well, so those patterns, those initial patterns are identifying the cells. And then from there, I will see, do those cells express the CCL3? And from there, like specific to my research, it would identify, okay, if CCL3 has this effect, could there be potential in targeting it with a medication? And there are already anti-CCL3 medications out there, such as for herpes, there's one for that. And so, you know, could there be use with this? And so all that would be determined about, you know, the results I find. But, yeah.
One thing that's always intrigued me about this kind of work, because mm-hmm. sometimes when you find these patterns
yes.
or these bad things, it's either you're wanting to block something from it happening in the first place, or you want it to be eaten up.
Yes.
And to go away.
Yeah.
And how do you determine which one?
You know.
Or is it whatever works?
It's difficult. I mean, there's obviously a bunch of different ways. Like, you know, there's all kinds of, I guess like an example would be like antidepressant medication. There's types that will, you know, increase serotonin.
Right.
Or it will block
something else going
something
through.
Else. Like, you know, there's all these different pathways. And so that's, you know, especially with medication, some medications work for people, some don't, specifically with IBD as well. You know, a lot of medications, it's a very, you know, kind of hard game of playing. Yeah, it's very personal to each individual what medication you're going to get. So there's a lot of medications being put out there with these different mechanisms that you just said about what to block, what to increase and all that. And so it's just finding kind of what works for a person.
Can I ask, and you may not, I'm going to ask you this question, and you may not be able to answer this, because I know you talked about the prevalence in Canada, particularly in children.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Children are still growing.
Yes.
So has there been any studies about those children who had it, had IBD, and later in life, whether it just went away? Because I wonder sometimes it's just a childhood thing and then they grow out of it.
Right.
Or is it once you've got it, you've got it? Because you said this is more potentially a genetic.
Yeah. So from my understanding, when, for example, someone is not experiencing symptoms or you know, they're healed, you classify them as they're in remission.
Okay.
So I don't know if it's...
So it doesn't necessarily go away. It's just there hasn't had that other trigger to get it started again.
Exactly. I think so, yes.
Which makes you think there's some block somewhere, right?
Exactly. So, you know, whatever drug you might be on is working well at that time. And now perhaps your immune system is more balanced again. Yeah, I'm not quite sure. That's, I think, more of a a doctor's question.
It's just one of those things, because you always think about children. They're going so much through so much growth. Yeah. And, you know, and even, you know, when does it first present itself? Is it an infant or is it, you know, all these things would come into play, I'm sure.
Oh, for sure. And so, I mean, it's weird. So they call it very early onset IBD. So in Canada, as I said, like this, you know, pediatric population is this very early onset, which is classified as children 5 and under. Okay. So it's, you know.
So it is early.
It is early. And so, you know, with my research, I get biopsy samples from adults, but I also get pediatric patients. And there's, you know, some very, very young children that are in that cohort as well. And it's a very different disease in children than it is in adults. The inflammation, like just looking at the biopsy, I use that score to, you know, give it a numerical value of how much inflammation they have.
Oh, is this the Naini and Cortina score you wrote in your little overview for me?
Yes, it is.
So tell me a little bit, I mean, because how good are these different scores?
Yeah.
And I guess this is all to do with your histology analysis and everything. So why use a score as opposed to just saying, well, this one's here and it's not there?
Yeah. Well, so I think using a score specifically for the use of research, it eliminates bias from it. Right. So for example, if I just looked and I said, well, that's inflamed, you know, that's not a good enough description.
That's
and
a good point.
Assigning these numerical values, you can really look at it on a scale as opposed to like a numerical scale versus just category inflamed, not inflamed. And so how this score works, and so they get developed by many pathologists collaborating together and, you know, oh, we've seen this a lot in patients with IBD. We think this is, you know, a bit like a marker of, yes, you will have IBD if you have this. But how the score I use, the Naini and Cortina score, is I've chosen this one over others. Most have focused on separating tissue types. So your small intestine, your large intestine, they're scored differently on different scores. Whereas with this score, it includes both.
Right.
So, and since I have tissue samples from all parts, that's why I've chosen it. And so it's the accumulation of features. So, and a couple examples of features would be architectural distortion of these. They kind of look like little fingers in your in your tissue. Yeah, they're called crypts, but they kind of look like little inverted fingers. And so they look a little distorted. So either split, crooked, you know, all that. Another one would be the invasion of a neutrophil, which is another type of immune cell. So I can see these cells.
So if you got those, you score this. And if you don't have it, you score this.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. And then so that accumulates over time or over that tissue. And then I, you know, it'll be a score of 0 to 17. So,
So explain a bit more about using this histology mm-hmm. analysis technique? Because clearly it's to do with these little layers that you're looking into.
Yeah. So
as opposed to looking at chemicals per se.
Yeah. So, I mean, using histology, so that is our method of identifying the state of their disease, so how severe they are with their disease. So right. kind of as I mentioned before, a patient might not experience symptoms, or, you know, when you do an endoscope, you might actually not see inflammation,
right.
but there'll be micro indications in the histology that there's still some inflammation. And so now when you're treating a patient, histology remission is now the gold standard of, like, that's the goal. You know, obviously it's great when you don't have symptoms anymore, but you will know that, okay, you are in remission. Like,
because
once,
nothing is there.
Right, yeah, now. At a micro level.
Okay. So is this the ultimate aim
yes.
of your study?
So the aim of the study is to quantify the CCL3 and understand that.
Understand that.
Yes. But ultimately, if we're looking on the big picture, understanding the disease is to improve treatment and how we're administering treatment.
Right.
And so, you know, all science really, you know, it's one puzzle piece at a time
mm-hmm.
in creating a larger picture of everything. So hopefully, you know, ultimately my research acts as a puzzle piece in understanding how IBD goes about.
It's interesting you said, you know, helping to find the treatment,
yeah.
right, of this. But the samples you're using is done through biopsies, which yes. isn't particularly pleasant.
No.
Is there any other way that we could be doing this?
Well, yeah, so there's
less invasive.
Yeah. The nice thing about mine is these patients are getting the biopsy either way.
Okay.
So I'm not, you know, telling them you need to get another one.
No.
So I'm taking them from archived samples.
Yes.
So they have to get them either way for diagnosis. But yes, there are different ways of looking and measuring proteins. So yeah, there's your blood. But so the reason we're focused in the tissue is because that's where the effect is being produced.
Which makes sense.
Yeah.
As opposed to what's been floating around.
Exactly.
Which doesn't necessarily say you've got this in this particular area.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. So that's why we're really looking at tissue, because it's very site specific.
Right.
And so especially if, you know, for example, where is CCL3 being expressed in the tissue? Is it more localized to, you know, the surface of, which is your epithelial barrier, like your gut barrier,
yes.
To kind of everything else? Like, is that where it being expressed? And, you know, that function might be, oh, it's destroying that barrier, and that's what's causing, like, the IBD, and, you know, letting pathogens and all that gross stuff, bacteria, in. Or is it localized? Is it just two different immune cells floating around? So again, like, yeah, looking at where it's being expressed. I can also identify the cells that are expressing it by looking at it. Not all cells, but some. That will give an indication to CCL3 function.
Can I also ask another question?
Yes.
Because you look, say, the 5 years and under.
Yeah.
And the prevalence, you said, was 0.08.
0.8.
Yeah. Percentage.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think with all the techniques and equipment and things mm-hmm. that we can look at today to figure out, oh, you've got IBD,
mm-hmm.
do you think actually that is not necessarily the true number? Because if you think 20, 30 years ago, someone who had a kid maybe with diarrhea might not have thought to come in and go, mm-hmm. okay, I just know how to treat diarrhea, da-da-da-da-da-da, and then you've missed it.
Yeah.
So it's only really those that have come into the doctor's office and the doctor said, you know, we should probably test for this.
Yeah.
So it's not really necessarily a true number, is it?
It's very possible that there are people mm-hmm. who just...
Because I wonder whether it's increasing or whether it's always been at a particular level.
Yeah.
We just haven't monitored it.
It's possible. I mean, you know, there are some patients that come in and, you know, my supervisor has talked about patients coming in, they're diagnosed at like late 70s.
Okay.
And so, you know, whether it started years ago or that year is, you know, I don't know those numbers, but it is possible that there are people who have it that just, again, yeah, haven't just made it to the doctor yet.
Mm-hmm. And I guess, again, this is not what you're studying per se.
Mm-hmm.
Is there a certain group that gets it more over another? Because you said it, genetics.
Right.
A little bit of genetics. I mean, is it? Apart from the age factor,
yeah.
males versus females or one culture versus mm-hmm. another?
I don't know in terms of cultural differences. I know that there hasn't been a big difference in gender differences. I was reading the other day that in children, apparently there's a higher prevalence in males before puberty, but then after puberty, it
bounces out.
Yeah. And I think that was with Crohn's disease. I'll have to double check that. But overall, no, not a huge difference. Mm-hmm. And then even with cultures, I mean, so another running theory is the diet theory. And so yes. The westernized diet theory right. of all that. And so I was looking at this other study and it was, you know, first generation immigrants going from low prevalence IBD country to high prevalence IBD country. They're not the numbers are split between
right.
first generation versus the people living in the country for a while. But that balances out within the second generation of immigration. So they right. do think it is a diet thing. But again, as I said, it was, you know, the theory is perhaps a genetic factor and then a trigger.
Right.
So that trigger could be diet and how it affects, you know, your yes. microbiome and all that. So I know that's a whole...
Microbiome in the gut.
Oh,
yes.
Yeah, exactly. There you go. That's a whole other, you know, division you can talk about, but...
I've spoken to some of those.
Oh, yes. Yeah. So...
No, it's all fascinating. So before I let you go...
Okay.
Because first of all, I know how much you've done on that, but you're also... I want to talk a little bit about... You're an avid polar plunge person. What made you want to go and plunge in freezing water?
Well, it kind of started, I guess. It's a this year kind of thing. Some friends and I were like, let's do this. And so, you know, I have family on the East Coast, and so they started doing that. And right. I was like, let's do it here, you know, a little competition. And I have to say, I think the warm weather we've been having has allowed us to continue on. I don't know how much longer we'll go. You know, we have the egos to say that we will do it the whole year, but that's to be determined. Come March and all that. Yeah.
Yeah, when you have to break a hole in the ice and then plunge.
Exactly. Yeah. So
it's meant to be very good for you, apparently.
Apparently.
I think it would stop my heart. Anyway.
Well, we do walk in because we are afraid, like, you know, the whole jumping in quick submersion, we're a little worried about that. So we do walk in, which is also not easy because I make it to my hips and I'm like, nope, I'm out, I'm bailing.
I do that in the swimming pool.
Yes. But no, it kind of just started out as a fun thing. So yeah, we'll see how far we get.
The things our grad students get up to have some fun. So, Eileen, I really do appreciate you coming in and telling us a little bit more about IBD and this CCL3 protein. And I'm sure there's a lot more that you can do to sort of help there. So thank you.
Thank you very much.
I really do appreciate it.
Yeah.
So that's it, everyone. Another week of Grad Chat sadly comes to an end. Don't forget you can download the show tomorrow from either iTunes, Google Podcasts, Spotify, and CFOC Podcast. Just type in Grad Chat. Until next week, this is CJ the DJ signing off with a big hooray.
Thank you for listening to this podcast produced at CFRC 101.9 FM at Queen's University, situated on the traditional territory of the Anishinaabe and Haudenosaunee peoples, and brought to you by the generous support of the Faculty of Engineering and Applied Science.